You're listening to DTFHN for August 30th, 2026. I'm your soldered together in a garage host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website what at the article, and the article usually loses. Today is about small things you can read all the way through, and the people who refuse to stop maintaining them. Crack the case open. Let's go. I built a pathfinding system once that was technically correct and completely useless. It found the optimal route. It just assumed the world was the map. That's the thing about geometry. It doesn't know what it's describing. This paper is a small masterpiece of exactly that tension. Two researchers, Chabakswar and Mukherjee, looked at a Reddit post claiming to show the longest straight line you could sail on Earth without hitting land. Pakistan to Russia, threading past Africa, through the Drake Passage, up to Kamchatka. 22,000 kilometers. Somebody drew it by hand and the internet said, sure, looks right. They decided to actually prove it. The engineering is the good part. A brute force search over every possible great circle on a sphere is computationally enormous. You're checking millions of paths against the global elevation grid at fine resolution. So they built a branch and bound algorithm. Prune whole families of paths the moment you can prove none of them can beat your current best. What would take months collapses to a few minutes on a laptop. And the answer was, the Reddit guy was right. To within a rounding error. Somebody eyeballing a map matched an exhaustive computational search. Then they turned the algorithm around and asked for the longest straight line over land. 11,000 kilometers, Liberia to China. Here's where the map bites back. A commenter pointed out there's a longer land route that gets excluded because it passes near the Dead Sea. And the algorithm treats anything below sea level as water. The Dead Sea shore is dry ground you can walk on. It's just negative elevation. The model's definition of land was a threshold, and the Earth doesn't respect thresholds. Another commenter noted, the paper's longest drivable straight line goes directly over the Alps. Walkable, maybe. Drivable, absolutely not. Neither of those is a failure. That's the loop working. Paper goes up on archive free to read. Algorithm described in enough detail that anyone can re-implement it. And within days, strangers are finding the edge cases and the definitions. Run this forward. Someone forks it, swaps the elevation threshold for actual land cover data, reruns it in an afternoon. The expensive part was never the compute. It was the idea that you could prune the search at all. That's the whole shape of good technical work. Someone guesses. Someone proves. Someone else finds where the proof's assumptions leak. And every step of that is only possible because all of it was in the open. Story 2 takes us somewhere completely different. Pause from mathematicians proving things in public to a bug that turns an error message into a way in. I love this job. The obvious counter-argument writes itself, so let me make it properly. Kubes exists to isolate. Its entire pitch is that a compromised virtual machine stays a compromised virtual machine. And here is a bug where a hostile cube reaches straight into DOM zero. The root of the whole trust hierarchy and runs whatever it wants. Not through some exotic chip flaw, through a shell escape in an error dialogue. If the security operating system can be owned by a file name, what exactly did all that architecture buy you? That's the strongest version. It fails, and it fails on its own terms. Strip this to first principles. What's the actual constraint? DOM zero must occasionally receive data from an untrusted cube. That's unavoidable. Information has to cross the boundary somewhere. So the real requirement is, every byte crossing that boundary gets treated as hostile. The QFile protocol sends back a confirmation at the end of a copy. Checksum. Error code name of the last file received. That name is attacker controlled. The sanitizer scrubs anything outside printable ASCII and strips double quotes. Then the error path builds a shell command string with a sprintuv and hands a to system. Single quote survive, semicolon survive, backtick survive. The sanitizer was written to make a file name displayable, and then someone downstream made it executable. Two correct looking functions, one lethal seam. Now, count what actually had to be true for this to matter. The attacker needs a kube already compromised. The user has to initiate the copy from DOM 0 to that specific kube. That's a narrow, contingent path. And the bug was found, written up in a public bulletin with the vulnerable source quoted line by line, signed, and shipped as an update, where the required user action is: keep updating normally. Compare that to the alternative. In a closed system, this is a CVE number and a vague improvements to file handling. Here, you get pack.c line 55 in the bulletin. One commenter on Hacker News read it and immediately asked the sharper question. Why is that dialogue rendering in DOM 0 at all, when you could handle attacker-controlled input in the unprivileged half and let DOM 0 stay dumb? That's architectural review, done by a stranger, for free, because the code was readable. The bemusing part isn't that isolation failed. Isolation worked exactly as designed and got bypassed by a convenience feature bolted onto its edge. Every serious security system dies at the seams, not the walls. The difference is whether you get to see the seam. Speaking of things you can read yourself. Okay, story 3. Spark lines in your shell. Tiny charts, no browser, no dashboard. Pure joy. Every terminal you have ever used can draw a bar chart. It just needed someone to notice. Here is the constraint. A shell pipe carries bytes. A number is a string of digits. And 100 numbers is a 100 strings of digits. And human eyes are catastrophically bad at reading 100 strings of digits. The information is all there. The bandwidth to your visual cortex is the bottleneck. Normally, you solve that by leaving. Pipe to a file, load a plotting library, wait for a window to open, look at a chart in an application that knows nothing about the shell you came from. Jason Dunenfeld Spark solves it without leaving. Unicode block elements. Code points 2581 through 2588. 8 glyphs, 1/8 height through full height. Normalize your inputs to a range of 8. Map each to a glyph. Print. That's the whole idea. The program is 1C file. Watch what that buys you. Pipe the USGS earthquake feed through cut, take field 9. Hand it to Spark. Magnitudes for every quake over 1.0 in the last 24 hours, rendered as terrain. Or take git log. Pull the dates, you nick-see them, awk out the counts, and you're looking at the pulse of a repository. Years of commits in 90 characters. No dashboard, no account, no web app that will be acquired and sunset. The input parser is the tell. It accepts numbers delimited by literally anything that isn't a digit, a dash, a period, or an E. The documentation demonstrates this by feeding it a line of pure keyboard mashing. Asterisk percent signs, parentheses, and Spark cheerfully extracts 11 numbers and draws them. That is not sloppiness. That is someone who understood that shell scripting is a hostile environment and decided to be the tool that never complains. And this is the part that matters. The cost of adding data visualization to your workflow just became run, make. No runtime, no package manager resolving 40 dependencies, no telemetry. Every user of this program is also structurally a potential maintainer of it, because it is short enough to read on the toilet. The site got hugged to death when this hit the front page, which is its own small comedy. The software that requires no infrastructure, taken offline by too many people wanting it. Archive.org has a copy. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. Sometimes it's 8 characters wide. 3 stories in, and the theme is starting to show itself. People building things small enough to trust. Story 4 takes that to the whole of Britain. 75% of Reform voters and 69% of Green voters agree on something. In British politics, that is roughly a solar eclipse. What they agree on is that no government. Not this one, not the next one, not one led by their own party. Should hold the keys to their encrypted messages. That number comes from polling public first conducted for the Center for Democracy and Technology. 2,000 British adults, weighted, margin of error, 2.2 points. 93% say they have a right to private conversation online. 89% say nobody reaches into their messages without a court order. 2/3 refuse to trust any government with the power. Labour voters at 58%, Conservatives at 59%. Lib Dems, 56%. The distrust is not partisan, it's structural. We have run this experiment before, and we have the results. April 1993, the Clinton administration announces the Clipper chip, an escrowed encryption standard where the government keeps a spare key, split between 2 agencies, released only under proper legal process. The promise was identical to the promise Westminster makes today. Access for the good guys. Security for everyone else. In 1994, Matt Blaze, then at Bell Labs, published a paper showing the law enforcement access field could be defeated in about 45 minutes of brute force on a workstation. Not a policy objection. An engineering finding. Clipper was dead within 2 years. 84% of British respondents said they worry an access mechanism creates vulnerabilities for hackers and criminals. They arrived at Matt Blaze's conclusion without reading the paper. A backdoor is not a legal instrument. It is a piece of code, and code does not check credentials at the door. It checks keys, and keys leak. Apple already pulled advanced data protection out of the UK rather than comply with a secret technical capability notice. 55% of the people polled had never heard that happened. That's the part that should land. The order was secret, the withdrawal was quiet, and the feature simply vanished from British phones. 65% said they would become more careful about what they like and share. 41% said they would stop criticizing government officials. That is the actual cost, not a hypothetical brief. A measurable contraction in what people are willing to say. The math on back doors has been settled since 1994. The politics haven't caught up. Back doors are a design choice, and so is the alternative. Which brings us to story 5, where someone decided to build the whole stack themselves. In a percent 10,000 bookwood, the filled ate a sepicide. Graduate student released a worm that took down roughly 10% of the internet. And the reason it spread was not brilliance. It was sameness. Everyone ran the same BSD, the same send mail, the same finger daemon, with the same unchecked buffer. One bug, one afternoon, thousands of machines. We learned the lesson, wrote the papers about monoculture, and then spent the next 38 years building an internet where essentially every packet on Earth is parsed by the Linux kernel's network stack. Which brings us to a developer named Like8503, who has decided the correct response is that everyone should write their own. The stated argument is straight-faced and completely unhinged in the best way. If a remote code execution bug in the Linux net stack would put every connected host at risk simultaneously, then that stack is a centralization problem. No different from a single root DNS operator or a single certificate authority. And if decentralization is genuinely the principle, follow it all the way down. Not just to the routing layer, not just to the protocol. Down to the code that reads the Ethernet header. Take the principle to its limit, and you get a world where every host speaks the same wire format and shares no implementation. It sounds absurd. It is also precisely what biology does. Then the punchline. It works. The project is called DNet. It opens a tap device, parses Ethernet frames itself, answers AR app, handles IPv4, replies to ICMP echo, does UDP. 4 years abandoned, recently dusted off, bugs patched, and a hand-rolled DNS server bolted on top. Right now, from any machine on the internet, you can dig a TXT record against a DN42 domain, and the answer comes back from a network stack one person wrote for fun while learning networking at university. You can ping it. It responds. Admire the craft here, because it is real. Writing a stack that survives contact with actual internet traffic. Malfirmed packets, weird NTUs, retransmits, everything the wire throws at you, is a different discipline from writing one that passes your tests. This one is serving live queries. The comment that stuck with me put it plainly. Good to see people still roll their sleeves up and do this for fun. And underneath the joke, there is a real point about monocultures. Both things are true at once. That is usually where the good work lives. Now for something that trades wire protocols for silicon. Python just got official RISC Sably support. Tier 3. That is the honest headline, and one commenter went straight for it. Tier 3 means RISC-V is still allowed to break without blocking a release. No one has to fix it on a deadline. By the strict reading, CPython has promised almost nothing. Take that seriously for a moment. Another commenter asks the obvious follow-up. CPython is written in C. So did this take more than a recompile? Weren't there surprises? If the answer is mostly no, then what exactly was accomplished here? A compiler flag and a page in PEP 11. That reading fails, and it fails on the word buildbots. The RISE project donated physical RISC VAN machines. Real silicon running the test suite continuously. The distance between it compiled once on someone's laptop and there is a machine in Iraq that will tell you the moment you break it is the entire distance between a hobby port and a platform. Tier 3 is not a weak promise. It is the first promise anyone made at all, and it is backed by hardware that exists. The next step is already in motion. RISC, every runner is moving into CI. So failure surfaced before merge rather than after. That is the part that compounds. Now the architecture, since it is the whole point. RISC-V is an open instruction set. Anyone can implement it. No license, no per-core royalty, no vendor deciding which customers deserve access. x86 and ARM are the alternative. And both are gates with owners. The ecosystem is projected to quadruple by 2032. One commenter wondered how to invest in RISC and RISC-IA and found every relevant company is private. Sit with that answer. The correct way to acquire a stake in an open ISA is to build on it. The specification is free. The tool chain is free. Python now runs on it, tested on real hardware. This was done by a handful of named people. Ludovic Henry, Furkan Onder, Emma Smith, and a maintainer funded by Sovereign Tech Agency Fellowship. Public money, open architecture, open language, permanent result. The output is not a product. It is a floor everyone else now gets to stand on. They are asking for exactly one thing. If you have RISC-V hardware, build CPython, run your test suite, and report what breaks. That is the whole contribution surface. It is open. Moving on. 3,072 cores, and each one draws 13 milliwatts. That number is the whole story. It's roughly what a single indicator LED pulls. Exena and Samsung built a chip where an entire general-purpose processor costs less power than the light telling you the device is on. Here's the shape of it. The MX1 is a CXL memory expansion card. Up to 2 terabytes of DDR5, 128 gigabytes per second to the host over PCIe 6, but it also exposes 8 downstream lanes for SSDs, and it can present that flash to the host as memory, with the onboard DRAM acting as cache. One reader put it perfectly. They've implemented MAP in hardware. What a time to be alive. The compute is where the craft shows. Those wristly cores are in order. Clocked at a leisurely 1.1 gigahertz. Grouped 32 to a cluster, sharing 128 kilobyte L2-4. Four clusters make a subsystem, 24 subsystems on the die. Each one an independent job. 4 kilobyte L1 data caches. Virtually addressed. So, a hit never touches translation at all. Instruction fetch doesn't use virtual memory whatsoever. Physical addresses only. Program counter restricted to predefined code regions. No TLB on the instruction side because there's nothing to translate. That single decision removes an entire category of hardware, and it removes the possibility of a core jumping in data. Four cores share an 8 kilobyte instruction cache, sized so a kernel hot loop fits inside it, since the programming model is CUDA-shaped. One kernel, many invocations, each looking up its own index. Those four cores are frequently fetching the identical address on the identical cycle. The sharing isn't a compromise, it's the point. The question nobody in these announcements wants to answer. What happens when the compute lives in the memory? And the memory is a card you plug in. Xeon Phi tried the many weak cores bet and lost, but it lost as a coprocessor competing with GPUs. This one sits in the memory path, where the bandwidth already is. And the cores are RISC-V, Samsung's 4-nanometer process, Exena's network on chip. An instruction set anyone can implement without asking. The specification underneath 3,000 cores is free. Run this forward. Moving on. What does it mean for a model to be a co-author of itself? Tencent released He4 preview this week. 770 billion total parameters. 49 billion active. A context window past 1 million tokens. Open weights. Available on OpenRouter, where it has apparently chewed through trillions of tokens in a couple of days. More than GLM 5.3 managed in a week. The traction is real, and it's real because you can just take the thing. But the line that stopped me is buried near the bottom. He4 participated in its own development. It proposed optimizations to training methods, data strategies, evaluation frameworks, and low-level operators. It ran the experiments. It read the logs. It iterated. Then it profiled its own inference stack, found the bottlenecks, fused some operators, tuned the communication layer, and made itself 31.8% faster end-to-end. Think of a sourdough starter. You feed it flour and water. It ferments. And the culture you pull off today goes into tomorrow's loaf. Each generation is slightly different from the last, shaped by what the previous one metabolized. Bakers keep starters alive for decades this way. The interesting part was never any single loaf. It was that the culture carries forward compounding and nobody fully controls what it becomes. Tencent just fed the starter its own bread. Now, the calibration. Their benchmark is an internal blind eval. 163 experts, 203 tasks. Where Hi4 scored 2.99 out of 4 against Kimi K3's 2.94 and GLM 5.3's 2.92. That is a gap of 500s on a self-administered exam. One commenter flagged the chart crimes in the release. Bars ordered by rank, except for the one that wasn't. Vendor benchmarks are marketing. Fine. The benchmark isn't the story, the weights are. Because a recursive self-improvement loop running inside a closed lab is a thing you read about in a press release. A recursive self-improvement loop you can download, inspect, fine-tune, and point at your own problems is infrastructure. Three Chinese labs are now shipping frontier-adjacent models with open weights, while the American labs ship API endpoints and blog posts. Whoever holds the starter decides who eats. This one got handed out. Now for something completely different, boy is story 9. Same energy, smaller scale. People keeping storage software free. One file system at a time. I built a NAS once where the boot drive was a USB stick I'd forgotten was there. Worked flawlessly for 6 years. The lesson wasn't that USB sticks are reliable. It was that a system you can fully inspect will outlive the assumptions you made about it. You can audit what you can see. FreeCore is that principle applied at the distro level. IX Systems ended development on true NAS core. The FreeBSD baseline. To consolidate on the Linux-based GARL. Reasonable business call. Fewer code bases, one Kubernetes story. Done. But core was open source, and open source has a property closed software does not. When the vendor walks away, the code doesn't. FreeCore took 13.4, rebased it on FreeBSD 15, and shipped 15.0U1 as stable. Existing core, 13.3 boxes upgrade in place, and stay on the update train. Your storage appliance did not become abandonware because someone's roadmap changed. Now, the due diligence question. Who controls this? Nobody with a quarterly number attached to it. That's the entire value proposition. The objective function of the FreeCore project is that FreeCore keeps working. And that's the only objective function there is. Which makes one comment on the thread land harder than it probably meant to. TrueNAS recently stopped publishing their build scripts. The code is still open. The recipe for turning it into a running system is not. That's a quiet architectural move. Source available, build reproducible only by us. It doesn't break the license. It just raises the cost of doing exactly what FreeCore did, which suggests somebody noticed. The comments carry real grief too. One person finally gave up waiting and sent an 11-year-old TrueNAS system through what they called the one-way Linux door, about a year before this existed. Another lost their Zvault fork. The site's gone entirely. Forks are fragile. Most don't make it. And there's a fair challenge in there. Why bother with a distro when vanilla FreeBSD and ZFS and a text editor do the same job? Because a web UI for snapshots and replication is the difference between 100 people running redundant storage and 10,000 doing it. Ergonomics is distribution. FreeBSD sure phone. OpenZFS. An independent team. A working upgrade path. Someone picked up a code base, its owner set down and kept it alive for everyone still depending on it. That's the whole thing. That's enough. So a small team keeping a code base alive out of care. What happens when lawmakers actually notice that people build software that way? Story 10. The strongest case against this exemption goes like this. A protection with a hole in it isn't a protection. If the whole point of the Digital Age Assurance Act is that a device knows whether a child is holding it, then carving out an entire class of operating systems creates a documented escape hatch. Any teenager who can read a wiki page, installs Fedora, and the age signal disappears. And the exemption isn't drawn around trustworthiness. It's drawn around a license. You could ship something genuinely hostile to kids under MIT and walk out of scope. That's a real argument. It deserves a straight answer. Here it is. The exemption isn't a hole in the law. It's the only thing that made the law coherent. The act works by having your operating system vendor collect your age, add account setup, and pass a signal downstream. That design assumes a vendor, someone with a legal department, a sign-up flow, an identity to attach to you. Debian has none of that. There is no account set up on Arch. There's a maintainer in Belgium and a mirror in Ohio. You cannot compel an age verification obligation from a volunteer project with no relationship to the person running the code, because there is no relationship. That's the architecture. Requiring one would not have produced verified kids. It would have produced fewer distributions legally distributable in California. Run it forward 5 years. Under the unamended text, every project that ships a bootable image faces a compliance question it cannot answer. So the rational move is to geofence or to stop shipping images or to add an identity layer to get legal cover. 5 years of that, and the only operating systems you can lawfully install in the largest state economy in America are the four that already have your identity. Child safety would be the mechanism by which general purpose computing quietly stopped being general purpose. Amendment does more than dodge that. It bans anyone from requesting an age signal unless the law requires it. Closing the door on that EVI becoming a general data channel, it fixes the definition that classified every device owner in California as a child. Buffy Wicks wrote the original act, took criticism from Linux developers and the EFF, and rewrote her own bill, 39-0. The technical community explained why the design didn't fit, and the legislature listened. That should happen more often than it does. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 30th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quinn 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go read something all the way to the end. We'll see you back here tomorrow.